September the 26th, 1943, 0600 hours. Awakened by a nurse. A female nurse, all pink and scrubbed in spotless uniform, smelling of pear soap. "Darling, I love you. Marry me," I said. "Good morning," she said. Threw back the mozzie net, and before I could answer it, it stuffed a thermometer in my gob. "It's down," she said. "What's down?" I said. "You're only 100. She bent over the next bed and showed two shapely legs. Oh, one would have been enough. Oh, I felt my temperature going up, 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 up again. I really was ill. I fell asleep and Audley woke me up with breakfast. The war was coming to life, but I wasn't. Audley's were taking on the last of the blackouts. Those patients who could were putting the mozzie nets up, trailing out to the ablutions, and others were swallowing medicines. Here comes mine. 4 white tablets. What are they? The orderly doesn't know. "I don't know. I don't have to," he says. "Then if you die, it's not my fault." Cheerful bugger. For the first 2 days, my temperature goes up and down, and so that I'm not alone, I go with it. At night, it was worse, with delirium and terrible dreams. However, gradually, I start to recover. The nurse, I wish I could remember her name, tells me of an incident. In the officer's section, there was a colonel from the RAOC. He's due for a hernia operation. The matron has been given the job of shaving him. She knocks on the door. "Come in," says the colonel. The matron comes in, throws back the bedclothes, lathers all around his willy and shaves him and starts to leave. The colonel says, "Pardon me, matron, but why did you bother to knock?" In the next bed is the Marine commander, Jamie Notton. He's in with our old friend Shellshock, received during the landings around Marina. He was 41, a bit old for a Marine commando. "I used to be a gentleman's gentleman," he said, speaking with a broad Scots accent. Jamie is sitting on the edge of his bed. He is in his battle dress, his boots highly polished, a hangover from his gentleman's gentleman days. His bed was immaculate. His heating irons and mess tins shined like silver. He basically wanted to do things properly. If he folded a newspaper, it was always perfectly square. But there the creation stopped. He could never make anything. It was always do. But what he did was perfect. He must have been an ideal servant. It's 11 o'clock of the morning. Outside, the sun shone that autumnal light more silver than gold. It beamed to the windows of our ward, favouring the beds who were on that side. In the centre of the ward are 3 trestle tables loaded with books, periodicals and newspapers. On one is an old Italian wireless set plugged up to a ceiling light. From it issues music from Allied Forces Network in Algiers. It's mostly dance band music, and singers like Crosby, Sinatra, Dick Hames, Vera Lynn, Anne Shelton, and Evelyn Doll. Who? The ward is big, high ceiling, plenty of light. All the bedside lockers have a water jug and glass. If you wished, you could have orange or lemon juice flavouring. In the locker were those torturous pieces of porcelain, the bedpan and the pee bottle. The attempt to make the place look homely, small tins with a few wildflowers, was very much appreciated. Since my admission, the sounds of artillery had daily receded. It was now reasonably quiet, save for the sounds of planes passing overhead. Some of the patients sat up in bed, some writing letters, some reading newspapers with headlines like, "Ambassador Kennedy tells President Britain is finished." If he meant after the war, he was spot on. Some soldiers had donned their dressing gowns and were seated on other patients' beds, talking, smoking or playing cards. The sick ones lay still, some asleep, some staring at the ceiling. We aren't a casualty ward, so we don't have any blood or bandages. The lad in the bed on my right is very ill and in an oxygen tent. He has pneumonia and looks ghastly. My temperature was down to normal in the day, up to about 100 at night. "Timmy, Jamie, how did you get into the commanders at the age of 41?
"At almost 30.
"Why didn't you say you were 13? You could have got out altogether."
"Oh, Spike, I want an adventure."
"You call this adventure?" He shows me photographs of himself outside his master's manor house somewhere in Scotland. "You left all this to come here?" He nodded ruefully.
"I must have been bloody mad," he said.
Well, he was now. He was interesting company, even though he was on tranquilizers and occasionally fell down. I sent him on errands like scrounging fags, getting my breakfast tray, bringing an extra cup of tea. He loved it. He was back in service again, so to speak, and I took advantage of it. "So I'll give you a breach to clean," he'd say, and I would say, "Yes."
I felt well enough to write another letter to my parents. My dear Mum, Dad and Des, I am officially somewhere else. That somewhere else is where I am. I am not at liberty to say. The whole of this land we have arrived in is now top secret. In fact, no one is allowed to know where it is. Even the people who live in it are told to forget that they are here. However, the bloody Germans know where it is and don't want to let us have it. Spaghetti. I've been here about a certain number of days, Spaghetti, and we all arrived here by certain transport and landed at a certain place at a certain time. All these facts I'm dead certain about, Spaghetti. We're allowed to mention the sky, so I'll say that we have in fact got one. It's directly overhead and high enough to allow us to stand up. The weather, well, it was nice and warm when we landed, but it's turning cool, as are the natives. And now there is rain every other day. I am not with the regiment at the moment, no. I've had an illness called sandfly fever. It's caused, the name suggests, by getting sand in your flies, which immediately send your temperature soaring. So despite the cold weather, I'm quite warm, thank you. In fact, my temperature got so high, walking patients used to sit around my bed at night to keep warm. Spaghetti. However, I'm better now. I've still got a temperature, but it's normal. Next, I'll be sent to a bloody awful reinforcement camp, where all the mud is sent to be slept on by unclaimed soldiers. So far, the battery has not sustained any casualties except me. Spaghetti. With the censorship as it is, it's pointless to write any more. All I want you to do is to write and tell me where I am. Spaghetti. Your loving brother, son, stroke brother, stroke midwife, Terry. September the 28th, 1943. My diary. The news says Jerry's evacuated Naples. Heavy rain. A Scottish sandy-haired, freckle-faced doctor is at the foot of my bed. He looks down at me and smiles as he looks at my board. Temperature down, then. Is it, sir? It's 99. How do you feel?
I feel about 99, sir.
I slept most of that day, waking up for meals. It was all very pleasant. The service, the sound of the rain, the bloke on the next bed dying. That evening they took him out for some kind of an operation, and he never came back. I remember the name on his chart was Parkinson, ACC. He was a cook, age 45, and he'd snuffed it. Poor bugger. Still, he was an army cook, and killed quite a few in his time. What news? There's an Ensor concert party in the big hall this evening.
What's Ensor? Said Jamie.
I told him every night something awful. The hall was packed. There is a proper stage. On the curtains are the faint outlines of the fascist emblem, which have obviously been unravelled in a hurry. A sergeant is in the pit on a lone upright piano. He strikes up a merry medley of tunes, Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover. And why shouldn't they be white with all those bloody birds flying over them? The curtains part, and there are three men and two girls in evening dress. They look like the squares of all time, and they're all singing, "Here we are, here we are, here we are again," which was an outright bloody lie, as we'd never seen them before. We gave them a good hand. A short, red-faced male with a fierce haircut and popping eyes comes forward and starts to wrestle with the microphone to bring it down to his height. Thank you, he gusses. Well, as we say, here we are again. He tells a series of terrible jokes, and we roar with laughter. He announces the Something Twins. On come two girls dressed as Shirley Temples. They sing "On the Good Ship Lollipop," and we wish to Christ that they were. They do a very simple tap dance. Storms of applause. Next, a male about 50 sings "The Bowmen of England" as if their bowstrings were all slack. He finishes. Storms of applause. On come the two girls dressed as sailors. Loud whistles. They all sing "All the Nice Girls Love a Sailor." The third male comes on. He's everything a comic should be except funny. About 45, rotund, evening dress, a flat cap, a glove on one hand. And after each joke, he transfers the glove to the other and says, "On the other hand," he ends up with a song that I forgot even as he sang it. He left an indelible blank on my mind. The pit pianist then plays the Stars and Stripes. Storms of cheers. What liars we are. So it goes on. It was a brave attempt to cheer the lads up, and we all appreciated it. It was well, though, we didn't have to pay. We wander back upstairs to our ward. It's night now. The blackouts are up. Dinner is on its way. "Spike, they're letting me out tomorrow," says Jamie. "You're going back to your unit?" "No, I'm going before a medical board. They're going to downgrade me." "You lucky sod." I don't think I'd like any more fighting. I should have stayed at home." And so ended Jamie Notton's dream of high adventure. I wonder what happened to him.
I wonder what happened to me. Thursday, September the 30th, 1943. I'm up and about. I'm okay. I'm cure. I'm normal again. I feel fine. I'm ready to be killed again. He's fit. Send him back. Yes, etc., etc. The Scots doctor on his rounds. So, you're leaving, Merrigan? Yes, sir, said Merrigan. How do you feel?
Very ill, sir. I feel very ill.
I smiled. Well, Merrigan, all the things come to an end, Merrigan. Well, was I the good thing? Help! Two new patients arrive and are dumped in the bed each side. Both are coughing like consumptives. What luck! If I hang around, I might catch it. Shall I kiss one? I wonder where the battery are and what they're doing. Going bang, I suppose. There's a barber among the patients, Rifleman Hausman. Anywhere or a haircut? There's no reply. Free, he adds, and he's knocked down in the rush. I let him loose on my head. When he showed me the result in the mirror, I nearly fainted. How's that? He said. Out, I replied. My head looked like someone had set it on fire. It was all for free, explained Rifleman Hausman. Brilliant recovery from sandfly fever by humble Lance Bombardier. So the headline should have run. All I got was a Lance Corporal suffering from incurable stupidity, who said, Bombardier Merrington. Well, that's almost me, I said. You are to be discharged tomorrow, Merrington. I see. I understand that my name is now Merrington, and I am to be discharged as fit. Yes, RTU. RTU? That baffled me. So I sang it to him in a mellow tune. RTU again, where it was spring. Oh, no, no, no. He blinked and made me sign a piece of paper that, in as many words, said, we have tried to kill this man, but failed. You will be ready by 030 hours and take the unexpired portion of your day's rations. Unexpired rations? The mind boggles. I started a series of farewells and looked deeply into the eyes of all nurses with a look that said quite positively, you're lucky I never screwed you. And they looked back with a smile that said, when you've been promoted to captain, knock three times. October the 1st, 1943. It's a mixed day, a souffle of sun and cloud. Outside the 76th General, a three-tonner truck is waiting like a wagon at the knacker's yard. A short, squat driver with a squint in his left eye finds and calls our name out from a bit of tacky paper.
Lance Bombardier Merrigan.
Yes, that's me. I'm Lance Bombardier Merrigan, I said. He called out the names of several more soldiers of the King, who at the sight of them would have abdicated. I inquire where we are being taken to. A corps reinforcing camp. He pronounced the word corps as corpse. Was it an omen? We all climb over the back of the tailboard. There's no roof, only the supporting struts. So started a journey of much boredom. Come, let us start. I look at the vacant stares of my travelling companions, all infantrymen. They had my sympathy. We drove for half an hour, during which time they never said a word. Like a fag, I said to one. Duh, he says. That was half his vocabulary gone, I thought. He was Irish. The roads are tarred and dusty. Tanks have ground away the surface. After half an hour, we passed through Battipaglia. We're going south, I said. Still no sign of animation from my companions. The buildings we pass are all much like I originally described. The colours, usually white, pale blue, deep blue, sometimes a light pink. Clusters of shops, small one-man affairs. All looking pretty run down and shabby. There are goods for sale, but none luxury. There's bread, vegetable, seasonal fruit, apples, walnuts, figs, grapes. Casa di Scarpa, a shoe shop. And they show a very poor variety of shoes looking very pre-1939. What was I talking about? My shoes were pre-1920. What was I doing in this war? It's only 3 years old. I'm older than the war. It's not fair. How can a three-year-old war understand a man of 25? We are passing freshly painted army signs, base ordnance depot, town major, Remy workshops, and what's this, VD clinic, so soon? Isn't love a wonderful thing? What isn't a wonderful thing is sitting in this bloody lorry with seven Australopithecae. British prisoners of war didn't give information when tortured by the Germans, simply because they didn't know how to talk.
That town was called Battipaglia, said the Irishman.
The act of speaking five consecutive words so exhausted him he lay down and fell into a dead sleep. We pass Italian military policemen looking scruffy and unshaved. They were performing helpful tasks like guarding German POWs whose asses they kicked in revenge, but they were getting weary of repeated insults from Allied soldiers giving fascist salutes with cries of Mussolini spaghetti added with raspberries. Suddenly the sky blackens. Great thunder clouds congregate. The temperature lowers. Spots of rain fall. The Irish soldier then made an incredible prediction. I think it's going to rain. And fainted. Immediately a deluge started. See? He triumphed. With no cover, we sat huddled in our greatcoats.
Are you all right in the back there? Came a voice from the cab.
Come on in, the water's lovely, I said. The journey seemed endless. Where in God's name are they taking us?
I think, said the Mick, I think they are just querying us.
As quick as it started, the rain stopped. The sun came out. Soon we were all steaming like wet laundry. At midday, the lorry arrives at a field of tents, fronted by a farmhouse. There's a sign. Corps Reinforcement Unit. We are sewn into the HQ. A corporal seated behind a desk.
Name, number, religion, regiment, he tells us. You are here to await pick-up by a regiment.
How long will that take, I said. He frowns.
I've broken the code. Well, I don't exactly know. So far, no one has picked up anybody. We've only been here for a week, so it will take a while for him to find a location. There are tented lines, two men to a bivvy. Party orders are posted on the board outside.
We walk along the line of muddy tents. I find an empty one. I see men walking rapidly with empty mess tins for food. I follow. We arrive at a field kitchen. Food.
Food?
Two slices of cold bully beef, a carrot, a boiled potato, a mug of tea, two biscuits. No mess tent. Eat where you stand. I see an intelligent face. His shoulder flashes read, Hampshire's. We get talking. His name is Arrowsmith. He was on the landings. He has shell shock. He looks a little like Ronald Coleman, slim, but 5'7", intelligent, sensitive. He speaks to me. It's simple arithmetic. The longer you are alive in action, the nearer you are to getting your lot. You see, I think, I rationalize, and that way you see only too clearly your death approaching. If I go back to my mob, I'll never see Blighty again. I came ashore with B Company. At the end of 3 days, me, the sergeant, and one private were all that was left. We were given replacements. 2 days later, me and two of the new replacements were all that was left. I mean, it's on the cards. One night, we were on patrol. We brushed with a Jerry patrol. A grenade explodes in a tree near my head. I don't remember anymore till I wake up in an ambulance. The quack says it's concussion and I'll soon be all right. All right, the cunt. He's talking about the outside. What about up in here? He taps his head with a spoon. It sounded hard-boiled. That's where it all happens, and inside me it says, no go. We go back to our tents. Can't sleep in these bloody things, said Arrowsmith, surveying his muddy bed. I suggest we look round for a dry place.
Dry loft, try.
Do you know what Basenji means, do you?
What?
Never mind, I said. We squat in our tents, we smoke and talk. At this camp, there was a morning roll call at 7 o'clock. Breakfast from 7.30 to 8.30, then prayed at 9. The rest of the day you did what you could with a muddy field and 200 tents. There was no transport, no entertainment, no money. The boredom was unbelievable. I mean, if a man sneezed, it was considered entertainment. The camp was about 300 yards from Red Beach, Salerno. For the next 3 days, Arrowsmith and I just foraged around, collecting walnuts and looking for war souvenirs. We had the occasional bathe, but the water was getting that first autumnal chill that made swimming nippy. The pioneer corps were on the beaches collecting war salvage, all middle-aged men, and we talked to them. Why did they join up?
Anything to get away from the bleeding missus.
They are all old soldiers, some from World War I. They're well organized. At lunch, they light a fire on the beach and are soon frying eggs and bacon.
Like some grub, said the sergeant.
Christ, yes, I said. The sergeant is a Londoner. He's about 50, big, burly, and used to be a fish porter at Billingsgate.
I was getting fed up, so I thought, have a go in a pioneer corps, why not? When they knowed I'd been a sergeant in World War I, they made me sergeant right away again. So straight on, I'm all right for lolly, eh?
He tells us about the perks.
The CO says, I go off and get some savage, so he takes a day's rations, bully beef and cheese and all that. We piss off somewhere and swap the bully and the cheese for either eggs or chickens. And we live like fighting cooks, but, he giggled, we don't do no fighting.
For 2 days we met them on the beach and gave them a hand picking up empty ammo boxes, shell cases, and were rewarded with marvellous grub. The last day they brought 3 bottles of white Chianti. We got back to the camp that evening very, very merry.
we had also solved sleeping in the mud. 300 yards east of our camp in the field, I spotted a small hut on legs. These are apparently farmhands' resting places during the hot harvesting season, made of straw with wooden slats for the supporting skeleton. It was lovely, dry and warm, and we slept very cosy that night. But all good things come to an end, in this case a cigarette end. We set fire to the place. The glow drew the attention of the enraged farmer, who came running across, and we had to grab our belongings, and wearing only our socks and shirts, ran like hell for the camp. We were stopped by the sentry, who had taken us to the guard room. The guard sergeant asked what we were doing, running around, half bloody naked. "Our grass hut caught fire," explained Arrowsmith. I couldn't speak for suppressed laughter. "What grass hut?" said the sergeant. We had to tell the story, and he put us on a charge for absenting ourselves from the camp. Next morning he forgot all about it. Well, not exactly. During the night he was convulsed with terrible pains in his side. He had a perforated appendix and was hurried to hospital. So next morning, I presumed he'd forgotten us. The subsequent guard commander said, "Piss off." The boredom was getting me down. One grey morning, I asked to see the OC.
"What for?" said the corporal. "It's about Basenji." "Basenji? Wait here."
He knocked on the door. A very crisp voice shouted, "Come in."
Opening the door, the corporal said, "There's a dance, brumming, drummadeer, million, 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 to see you, sir."
I was ushered in. The OC was a major. He was a bright red. He wore a hat. Under a bulbous nose was a pepper and salt cavalry moustache. His chin was a mass of small broken veins. He blinked at twice the normal rate, and from time to time sniffed what was a running nose. He would be somewhere between 39 and 97. It was hard to tell. He was writing an aerograph, which, on my approach, he hurriedly covered with a blotter. Silly sod.
What do you want?
He said curtly. "This will come as a surprise to you, sir, but what I want is a job." He looked at me, blinked and sniffed.
"A job?"
He stressed the word and said it again.
"Job?"
"Yes, sir."
"Being a soldier is a job."
"Well, I want a job on top of that, sir."
"What kind of a job?"
"Any kind, sir. It's the boredom here. It's driving me mad."
"You think you're alone?"
"What's your army trade?" "It's a wireless operator."
"Well, I'm sorry we don't have a wireless set for you to play on."
"Any other job, sir. Otherwise I will desert."
"Desert?
Look. Look here. Go to the Q stores, see Bombardier Logan, tell him the major said you are to help him." I saluted and left him to his aerograph. As I closed the door behind me, I heard him give a gigantic sneeze and say, "Bugger!" Bombardier Logan turned out to be a Scot. He didn't have a face, just an area under his hat. His eyes, mouth and nose were all in conflict as to what should be in the centre. It turns out he was an ex-boxer. By the look of his face, every punch had got through. His ears were mangled fragments of gristle and skin. He was partially deaf. Then he was only partially human. He was from Glasgow, and he spoke with an accent no one could understand, not even himself. He walked stooping forward, his arms hanging ape-like, a square head with real corners on it. From 8 in the morning to 8 at night, I worked. There was nothing else to do. If there had been, I'd have done it. He took pity on me and said, "You'll have some tea chest to make yourself a bed." Apparently he was saying you could have some tea chest to make yourself a bed. He permitted me to sleep in the same room. It was dry and had 3 hurricane lamps in, so at least one could read in bed. Having nothing to read didn't help. By day he talked to himself in Scottish guttural, interspersed with snatches of Scottish folk song. It nearly drove me insane. The Scots had taught the bagpipe to the Canadians, the Australians, the Indians, the Gurkhas, the South Africans, the Rhodesians, even the Chinese. My God, they had a lot to answer for. The bombardier couldn't even converse. Saying hello to him had him baffled. Every night he regaled me with stories of his boxing prowess. He'd had 200 fights. I asked him how many he'd won, and he said 7. He showed me a picture of his wife. She looked like she'd had 200 fights as well. She had, with him. What he really needed was a head transplant. Suddenly, with no warnings, we had to move. A back-breaking 24 hours loading stores onto lorries, again in the pouring rain. The major, his name escaped me, but I think it was Castle, must have felt pity, for as the bombardier and I sat in the empty storeroom, soaked,
He brought in a bottle of whiskey and poured a liberal amount into our tea mugs.
You've worked very well, Merrigan. I appreciate it. It's been bloody hard, boring time setting up this unit. We've had bugger all cooperation. All the stores, etc., have all been rushed up to the front lines. That's why the food's been so bloody awful. This place we're moving to, things will be much better.
Well, that was nice. The first comforting words I'd had for weeks. Before he left, he said, "Before we leave tomorrow, any questions?" "Yes," I said. "What's Vicenzi?" He frowned, walked back a few paces, and then came back towards me.
What?
"Vicenzi, sir. What's it mean?"
"I've no idea. Is it an Italian word?"
"I don't know, sir."
He stood a while, then turned and left in silence. The Scottish bombardier drained his mug.
"It's an African dog," he said.
"What is?"
"Vicenzi."
"An African dog."
"Can they bark?"
My God, he knew what Vicenzi meant. How did he know? I was desperate to find out.
I was once bitten by one in South Africa.
Where?
I told you. South Africa.